The first case this morning is Thompson v. Retirement Plan.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Eli Gottesdiener. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiffs, and I'm asking for the court to reverse the district court on the two issues that are presented here, the statute of limitations question and on the projection rate question. There are a lot of complex pension concepts involved in this case, but really this case comes down to contract. Yes, Your Honor. There are a lot of complex pension questions involved in this case, but at bottom, it comes down to contract. The statute of limitations question and the projection rate question are questions simply of contract. On the statute of limitations question, reversal is required because the district court's ruling that plaintiffs and participants' rights under the plan were eliminated because they slept on rights that the plan fiduciaries, through fiduciary communications, told them they did not have. This court's holding in Young v. Verizon compels reversal. Stare decisis. The principles of that case are that a participant is entitled to rely on the four corners of the participant communications and summary plan description that they are provided. In Young, this court held that Ms. Young, who had been given participant communications that inaccurately summarized the terms of her plan, was not under any duty to go out and investigate things. There was no red flag. The payment she then received after receiving these communications was completely consistent with the plan as described to her in the summary plan description. That's the first principle that comes out of Young. The second principle that is explicitly stated by the court in Young is that there can be no clear and unequivocal repudiation of rights under the pension plan that has been made known to the participant unless the plan specifically speaks to the participant and says, "We deny your claim. You are asserting a plan claim that does not exist. We interpret the plan differently." In Young, the court explained that that had never occurred. That had not occurred because Ms. Young, of course, when she received her lump sum, calculated consistent with the terms of the summary plan description that had been provided to her, had no idea that she had a claim. Now, in Young, Verizon, the Verizon plan, there were two claims. One was the double transition factor, and that was one that actually Verizon had thought about and had actually, in its mind, decided it would never honor. But it had never told anybody that. The second claim was based on language in the plan, again, that she was unaware of, as to what appropriate discount rate should be used for calculating her opening lump sum balance. The court said that at the time, hearing arguments that were identical to the ones made here. In fact, this court was cited the district court's decision below in the briefs and at oral argument. Verizon relied on the district court's decision here for its incorrect interpretation of this court's standard for a clear and unequivocal repudiation. For a clear and unequivocal repudiation, you can't just pay somebody and say, "Here's your money. Any possible claim that you may have," this is all implicit,
there really isn't any statute of limitation. Is that right?
No, that is not right, because what they could
have deferred forever.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The way the statute of limitations would start to run is if the plan fiduciaries accurately described the terms of the plan. What they did here was they misdescribed the central operating principle of the plan. They didn't tell people your right to future interest credits is non-forfeitable. If you leave your money in the plan, if you take your money out of the plan, it's not even money, it's an account, you will still get future interest credits.
Well, they didn't say that, did they?
No, they didn't. That's our point, is that they told them you have to earn your credits. You don't own them. You have to earn them by doing what? By staying put in the plan. If you don't stay put in the plan, you have no right to future interest credits. That is exactly what the SPD says over and over. You have to leave your money in the plan. If you pull your money...
Why isn't that a clear signal that you don't get any future interest?
It is, but it's not our plan. They're describing...
So what?
Let me try it again. It's not the plan under which my clients accrued benefits, Your Honor, provides them with a much greater benefit. They were describing a defined contribution plan. They were describing a savings account. They said it was a savings account. If you put your money in a savings account, do you expect to get future interest and an additional amount beyond what had been posted to your account while your account was still there? No. This is not an account plan. The SPD is essentially a lie. It's describing a plan that our plan is not. Our plan is much more favorable. Our plan is a plan that says, come what may, you get future interest credits all the way to age 65, even if you pull your account out. It's counterintuitive. There's no question about it. And what they did
is... Why isn't that a repudiation of your rights? I don't follow your argument.
It's not a repudiation of the rights under this plan. Let me try it another way. If they tell you you're entitled to your account balance and nothing more, but then it turns out, as in Verizon, that there's language in the plan that says you're entitled to a whole lot more, our claim is for the whole lot more.
But that language is not in the plan.
Yes, it is.
Erroneously, as you contend.
No. And this is extremely important, Your Honor. There's two things, and the defense misrepresents our contention repeatedly. There's two different rights that you need to keep clear. There's the contract right to non-forfeitable future interest credits. They are wrong that ERISA imposes that. ERISA protects contract rights. It doesn't create them. The second right that is in the plan that is illegal, that ERISA steps in and says something about, is the value of those future interest credits. So they promise the rights of future interest credits all the way to age 65, but they separately devalued them to the point where they were worth nothing. Think of a liquidated damages clause in a contract. Two parties make a contract. What the law required, this is the second part. Keep on, if you keep your eye on the ball with the contract claim, you do not, they are wrong under ERISA, and I am going to show the court that they are wrong. You do not have to guarantee future interest credits through age 65. Notice 96-8. In Berger, the court said it is an authoritative statement of the applicable statutes and regulations. Notice 96-8 describes two kinds of plans, a front-loaded interest crediting plan and a back-loaded interest crediting rate plan. And Judge Cudahy, a savings account is a back-loaded plan. Only do you get the interest when it's posted to your account. When you pull your account out, goodbye. You don't have any right to future interest credits. This plan promised, even if you pull your account out, they're going to do a projection, all of which was hidden from participants. That's the right we're claiming. But the violation of ERISA was pricing it at the 30-year Treasury. There's two steps to the contract. There's the granting of the right to future interest credits all the way out to age 65, like in Berger, totally unconditional. Berger was a typical case where everything was front-loaded. Stapled to your pay credit was the right to receive interest credits all the way to age 65. You owned it. You didn't have to earn it, Judge Cudahy. This repudiates nothing because they're telling you that in order to get the credits, you have to stay put. That's a lie. The plan says you already earned them. And if you want them early, and that's the liquidated damages clause analogy, then what happens is we're going to cash you out. ERISA steps in only at that point and says you've got to pay the fair value, just like at common law. If you and I made a contract and we had a liquidated damages clause and I said it because I had more power or I wrote the contract alone, unilaterally, which these contracts are, and I set it unconscionably low, the courts would step in, void it, and say, let's have a trial on damages. And I just gave you our argument on the second point, which is why the district court has to be reversed. You don't defer to the defendant when the defendant breaches a contract and say, what's the lost stream of future profits that the plaintiff was going to make? It's for the court to decide. You also, especially in the ERISA context.
You only get there, of course, if you get beyond the statute of limitations.
And I'm telling the court, under Young v. Verizon and fairness.
If you're over-reading the Young case, are you stuck with Judge Stattmuller's determination on the statute of limitations?
Well, if the court finds, could I just ask the court to give me one more moment on Young v. Verizon. I don't think I'm overreading it because Young specifically says that you need to have the dispute on the table. These are pension rights. It's not just a repudiation like goodbye. It's a repudiation specifically under Dahl. Look at the opinion. Look at Dahl. The man wrote them, and they wrote back, and he wrote again. It was a formal application that wasn't required. He already went through the process and specifically said, I've re-earned my right to credits because I had sufficient quarterly credits now. They said no. Then he comes back years later. But it was after they gave him a written determination and they disabused him of his understanding. And in Young v. Verizon, the court says specifically, interpreting Dahl in a parenthetical, it says, in Young, that didn't happen. The parenthetical to Dahl says it disabused him. It disagreed with his understanding of rights under the plan. That never occurred here, and that's exactly what the court said in Young. That didn't occur. Young got a lump sum. Same situation here. She didn't know that there were two claims that she had. When she later learned them, by her lawyer finding a copy of the plan, by asking for it, years later, she then asserted that, and this court held squarely that only then, when it's out on the table, when you tell the participant, this is a fiduciary relationship, you need to hit the participant with a 2x4. You need to say, I'm your fiduciary, and I am now adverse to you. I am adverse to you as to your interpretation of the plan. In this case, just as in Young, the basic terms of the plan were misrepresented. In this case, they told people you do not have non-forfeitable rights. Your rights are conditioned. You do not own them now. You need to earn them. So, Judge Cudahy, when you got your lump sum equal to your account balance, you went back to reading your newspaper because everything checked out, and that's exactly Young v. Verizon. Everything checked out for Ms. Young.
Young had a lot of aspects that this case doesn't have. That's the only.
And I'm telling the court that is incorrect. This case is a contract case. ERISA does not create contract rights. It enforces them.
So if you're wrong about Young, then you're wrong on the statute of limitations argument.
No, if I lose on the if the court were to find somehow that just paying people and sending them a communication that is flatly wrong, flatly inconsistent, it is, Your Honor, it is flatly inconsistent with the terms of the plan. The terms of the plan promised non-forfeitable credits. You'd have no way of knowing you were injured. There, essentially, you would find the court should not feel good about finding that people slept on rights that they were told they did not have. There's no way for them to have known this. Every statement in the SPD
specific statements about you have to earn the credits. Your right to future credits stops when you pull your account out. It is totally unfair to see that as anything other than a misrepresentation. And you know what? Of course, they say we didn't know we were violating the law. The record is very clear. They testified in depositions, and they've said in their papers they couldn't have known. It was all very complicated, and they didn't know the law. Our argument is not, Your Honor, ignorance of the law is no excuse. It's ignorance of the facts. The court should look to Judge Crabb's decision in the parallel case where she went through the exact communications, the Rupert v. Alliance cash balance case. She went through the exact analysis here, and she said, it's impossible to say that somebody was put on notice. And she answered your question.
Go on for 25 years without being injured. Isn't that right? She said you could go for 25 years without being injured.
She said in response to the district court, who said you could go 25 years without bringing this to anybody's attention, correctly, she rejected that, and she said, what's wrong with showing up 25 years later when they concealed your rights for 25 years? She directly took that on, and there's only one answer. There's only one answer on the facts. There's only one answer on this court's precedents. Just recently, Young v. Verizon, there's no way around it, Your Honor. There's two principles. One, you can rely on the SPD. That is a necessary premise of the holding, that stare decisis. Two, that repudiation requires it to be on the table. It's got to be a dispute between the parties. These are pension rights. And at that point, what you need is an actual live dispute where you tell somebody, we repudiate rights under the plan that you believe you have, but we're telling you you do not have. And to now answer your question about, we still win on subclass A, Your Honor, with respect to the statute of limitations, because at a minimum, even if you were to find that the communications were sufficient to start the clock ticking for the other people, you cannot find constitutional injury, you cannot find standing or rightness, and here's what you have. You have a pension plan. The default is the annuity, the age 65 annuity. It was entirely speculative at the time that they say the clock started ticking on people that these people would terminate at a time before age 65, that they would request a benefit before age 65, and they would request a benefit in the form of a lump sum. And when they did all of these things in the future, they'd have to get the consent in writing of their spouse. Their spouse at the time. At the time these people are saying the statute of limitations started running, they may have had a different spouse. It is impossible to find that there is injury at that point in time. In addition, the fact is that there, again, is a fiduciary relationship, and the fiduciary is required. They've admitted these are illegal plan terms. So, and they say that they can rewrite them at this point, which we reject. But if the fiduciary is a fiduciary, they're always got the last clear chance not to harm the participant and not apply the illegal provisions. So subclass B's claims necessarily survive.
I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I guess he didn't need to raise his voice after.
Mr. Clement.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Paul Clement for the appellees, cross-appellants. There's one point on which I and my friend definitely agree, and that is that these plans, from the beginning, in the SPD and the other communications, made it clear that the plaintiffs were not going to get the benefit that they seek. And that benefit is future interest credits in addition to their vested account balance. As we both agree, the plan in its communications could not have made more clear from the outset that if you left early, if you took your lump sum benefit, you were not going to get your interest credits. Those were available to you if you left the company and kept your money in the plan. That is the clear repudiation that starts the clock for statute of limitations purposes. And I'm
so the day an employee gets the SPD in their employment packet or whatever it is, the statute starts running. They should file suit that day, the very day they start work, or within a week or so, to avoid the statute problem.
Well, there's a generous statute of limitations here of 6 years, so I think the action accrues that day. They have 6 years to bring the action, but I don't think there would be any obstacle to coming into court and bringing the action at that point and saying, look, I've been given this SPD, and this SPD tells me that I'm not getting something that I believe I'm entitled to under ERISA. And I think it's important to recognize. Now,
and that would be right.
That would be right. That would
even though the employee has not, let's say they have vested, but they haven't left the company, they haven't pulled their money out. They have a ripe action.
I think they do, Your Honor, and I think they do for two reasons. I mean, there's a question of essentially maybe prudential ripeness, if you want to think about it that way, under the statute. And the statute's very clear. The relevant statute here, 1132A, says that you have a right to recover a benefit denied and to get a declaration about what your benefits are. So I think ERISA understands that it's going to be very important for plan beneficiaries in certain circumstances to get that ability to know what their benefits are. Now, as to constitutional ripeness, I still think that there is sufficient ripeness. And I think it's important to understand what is at stake here. If you think about the claim here, I think it's not just the person who takes their lump sum benefit at a future point in time that's entitled to the actuarial equivalence. I think this is the ERISA policy here reflects the idea that you're really supposed to be made indifferent to whether or not you keep your money in the plan or you take it out of the plan. And that's essentially why, in addition to tax qualification, why you have this relatively unusual right, or did until the Pension Protection Act, to take your money out and still earn interest credits. And I think, essentially, anybody subject to this plan was being told, boy, if you leave the company, you face a choice. You can either take your lump sum payment, but then you sacrifice your future interest credits. And as a participant in this plan, I would have had an ERISA right not to be forced with that choice, and I would be able to go into court and vindicate that right. And I don't think that's that different from a situation like Winnett, the Sixth Circuit case, where one of the benefits that was allegedly denied there was they were supposed to get a fully funded health care plan, and they were told at a certain point in time, well, based on some contingencies, we've changed this, and you may have to pay some premiums down the line, but not until this other funding mechanism expires. And the Sixth Circuit in that case didn't say, well, you have to wait until all of that happens and then bring your action. They said, no, that action accrued when you were told that you no longer had those benefits. The Eighth Circuit case in Beckham, I think, is similar. There, when there's a merger in the company, they basically tell the new employees for the new company, if you join the new company, you're not going to get any credit for your prior service to the old company. Now, that didn't make any immediate difference to those people. That was something that would depend on how many credits they got down the road for retirement, but it didn't make an immediate difference to them. And yet the Eighth Circuit said, that's when it accrues. That's when the clear repudiation accrues. And as I said, this is a rule that I think is a particularly clear rule in the ERISA context. And I think if you think about ERISA, it makes sense in this context. Because by its nature, these are rights that may have a very long tail. I mean, Judge Crabb, in a Rupert opinion, said that you could bring this case 25 years later, and that would be okay. And in a sense, she has to say that. That is the logical implication of plaintiff's position, because if you're talking about future retirement benefits for somebody who leaves the company when they're, say, 30, after, say, they have 5 years, they vest, they leave at 30, there's another 35 years before that right is completely extinguished. And I think that's the character of ERISA plans generally. You do have these benefits.
How do you distinguish Young, Judge Tinder's opinion?
Well, I think Judge Tinder's opinion in Young is quite distinguishable. And I think it's a very different situation, because in Young, the problem is, at bottom, you have a contract claim. And you have a particular contract claim, which is that the SPD and the plan document have different language. The plan document has the duplicative calculation. The SPD doesn't. So in that situation, especially since you're given the SPD and you're not given the plan document, if you get what you're told you're entitled to under the SPD, I mean, you don't have any idea that you have an additional contractual right. What's so different about this is, at bottom, and I do disagree with my brethren on the other side on this, at bottom, the claim here is not a contractual claim. The claim here is a statutory claim. It's an ERISA violation. The plaintiff got exactly what they were told they were going to get under the contract. They were told they were going to get a lump sum payment of their vested account balance. That's exactly what they got. If you look at the plan, sure, it tells you how they get to that, and it eventually tells you that we do it by using a present value calculation and then backing it down to current value using a discount factor. But that's just that's in a sense the math that gets you there. But the contract, right? I mean, the statutory violation that is at bottom of this claim is the claim that they were entitled to additional benefits in addition to their vested account balance. That was clear from the beginning. And there's no disconnect between the SPD and the plan on that. I mean, the plan provided additional details as how you get to that net conclusion, but there's no disconnect there. So that's why I think Young is a very different situation. In Young, you get what the plan tells you, and you don't even know that you might have a contractual right to something else you get what the SPD tells you, and you don't even know you might have a contractual right to something else in the plan. Here, plan, SPD, plan communications all say the same thing. If you leave early, then you're not getting those interest credits. If you want those interest credits, you can leave the company, but leave your money in the plan. And so that's why I think Young is such a clearly distinguishable case. It's at bottom a fairly unusual set of circumstances. One could think of it even more narrowly as a case about how you deal with sort of Scrivener's errors for statute of limitations purposes. But even if it has a broader reach than that, I think it really doesn't extend to a situation like this where there was no disconnect between the SPD and the plan. The right that's asserted here, the right to additional benefits in addition to the vested account balance, you were told from the get-go, you don't have that right under this plan. Now, I do think, too, that, I suppose you could conceptualize the right slightly differently as a right to the actuarial equivalence. But even then, this plan put you on notice that you weren't going to get that because it told you two things. It told you that you were only going to get your vested account balance, and it also told you what the interest credit calculation was, that it was 75% of the plan's earnings or a minimum of 4%. And if you put the SPD and those facts, that you only get your vested account balance, that you only get interest credits if you keep your money in the plan, and the interest credits are calculated in that way, there is no way to square that with the benefits that they got. I mean, if you put those plan provisions side by side, say, with the Edson decision from the First Circuit in 2000, you would have realized this plan was problematic. And so the clear repudiations of the benefits here really does go back to the beginning. I think one point I'd emphasize on the statute of limitations point, I don't think it's critical to it, but I think it's worth mentioning. Oftentimes, when you're talking about applying a statute of limitations, there are obviously fairness concerns with that. Doesn't stop the court from doing it, but there are fairness issues at play. Obviously, there are fairness issues on both sides because there's a certain unfairness in having to litigate stale claims. But what is a little unusual here is that the statutory claim at issue here, the claim to these benefits, is one that Congress actually eliminated prospectively in the Pension Protection Act of 2006. So this is a situation where I think one way of looking at it, what's at issue here is something that's a bit of a windfall. It is a right that the Congress prospectively has not agreed to recognize anymore. Now it's perfectly fine to say in a cash balance plan you get your vested account balance and that's what you leave with. Now I'm not trying to make the strong argument that the Pension Protection Act is retroactive. It's not. It's prospective only. But I do think in a world where a court, when applying the statute of limitations, naturally may take into account fairness concerns, those concerns are attenuated here. The Pension Protection Act, I think, makes this a case where there's no reason not to apply the well-established principles of the statute of limitations, which has the consequence of eliminating all of
now,
these claims.
Stadmiller seemed to walk away from the repudiation, and he He wanted to tie accrual to injury in some way. I'm not sure exactly what the connection was.
And I agree, and I think there is a sense in which, I mean, you know, there is a sense in which I think the repudiation becomes even clearer at the point you're cut a check and you're not getting anything more than what you were told you would get. But I guess my way of looking at it is, although it was even clearer when the check was cut, that actually helps explain why the repudiation goes back to the plans here, because the check you were cut was from exactly the amount you were told you'd have a check cut. You're told from the beginning in the documents that it would be your vested account balance. Every year you got a statement that told you what your vested account balance was, and here's a check that corresponds to that amount. So I do think the injury here really does reach back to the beginning of the case. Now, as I said, I think because of the Pension Protection Act in particular, there's no cause here not to apply the ordinary ERISA rule of accrual. I also think if you were to reach it, there would be no reason not to apply the ordinary ERISA principle of deference. I mean, needless to say, if you side with us on statute of limitations, you don't even reach the question of how to calculate these benefits that were deprived. But I do think that if you get to that issue, the right answer is that it is not either an issue of fact that can just be determined in some sort of specific way, and it's not an issue of law just for the court. It really is something where, almost by necessity, it has to be something where the plan is given the first opportunity to come up with the essentially the projection rate.
Judge Crabb dealt with that at some length in Rupert and rejected it.
She did.
Rather persuasively.
Well, I hope you won't find it persuasive. I actually find what Judge Crabb ultimately did to, in a sense, be a cautionary tale about going down that route, because I think it puts the judge in really an untenable position of trying to sort of, you know, have a couple of experts. And it's different, I think, and this is critical, it's different. It's not just sort of an ordinary valuation question.
This was not a discretionary decision. That was the basis of which I must say, confess, I don't thoroughly understand that principle.
And here's why. She did say it, but I think it's wrong on two levels. I think it's wrong as a matter of the Berger decision in this specific context. I also think it's wrong as a matter of ERISA law more generally. The reason I think it's wrong in this specific context is, as the court recognized in the Berger decision, you're estimating a future stream of value, and it's estimation. It's not determination. There is no one platonic form of estimating that. You can't get, you know, 20 bishops in there and hear evidence and then decide, boy, this is the absolute best way to do it. There's some inexactitude, and you could use a spread methodology, you could use a stochastic method to project a fixed rate, you could use the five-year average of the Treasury regulation. All of those, I think, could in theory, I mean, putting aside the specifics of this case, in theory could be fair and unbiased ways of making this estimation. And I think if you would hypothesize a plan that back in 1998 fully foresaw the Edson decision in Berger and had all its ducks in a row, I think if a plan had adopted any one of those methods, you would be inclined to defer to it. But I think, so I guess the two points was, one, under Berger, the recognition that this is estimation rather than determination means there is of necessity some discretion. The other question is, I think if you think about it in that hypothetical way, that if a plan had addressed this issue back in the day and gotten everything right, gotten the ERISA law right, it would have had substantial discretion to pick the right formula. Now, I think that what Conkright teaches us is that just because the plan got it wrong back in the day doesn't mean that they lose their ability to get deference.
And would you concede that Judge Stattmuller, though he didn't accept your plan's program completely, he deferred to it substantially in reaching the result that he did?
Well, I guess what I would say, not to quibble, I think he recognized at a minimum that this is something where the judge should not just go into a trial on valuation. You should give the plan the first crack at coming up with a methodology.
Well, and why is that? Because at that point, liability is clear that you were wrong. The ERISA required the whipsaw provision, and you simply didn't have it. It's really a matter of damages only at that point, isn't it?
I don't think it is, Your Honor, and I think it goes back to the ERISA claim at bottom. The ERISA claim at bottom is not a claim for damages as it is in ordinary civil litigation. It's a claim for benefits denied. So what you get to collect is not sort of the consequential damages from not having that money and you would have invested it in Microsoft. And you don't get damages in that way. What you get is the benefit denied. And so then you need to calculate what was the benefit you were denied. And depending on the projection formula you use, that number can be higher or lower. And depending on the benefit formula you use, it can be higher or lower for different members of the class. And one of the reasons, for example, we think the spread methodology is the best method is it's the only method that really treats all members of the class the same, no matter when they took their lump sum distribution. The problem, one of the problems with, say, the proposal to use stochastic variables to get, let's say, a higher, like, fixed number, is that you can really game the system based on when you take your distribution, based on what the discount rate is. And conversely, the five-year average that Judge Stadmiller eventually adopted has that character as well. Depending on when you take your money out, you may have a very high five-year average, a very low five-year average.
The problem I'm having is those seem like trial issues to me. I'm having difficulty understanding why your client gets the first crack at that.
Well, because at bottom, what is it? I mean, it's a question of what benefit were you denied? How can you figure that question out? You have to know what benefits, essentially you have to have engage in the hypothetical exercise of what benefit formula on the projection would the plan have adopted? I mean, and you have to answer that in a sense, you're answering a hypothetical question, because we concede the plan in the first instance didn't have an appropriate projection formula. It said 30%, you know, 30-year treasury bill. That doesn't work. We admit that. But we now need to know what it was. And in answering that question, I don't see how you can answer that question without giving the plan the first crack and evaluating what kind of benefit formula they would have adopted back in the day. And I think that's consistent with all sorts of ERISA law. I think it's consistent with Conkright, which says you don't lose the deference you otherwise would have got just because you make a mistake in the first instance. I think it's consistent with this court's decision in Gallo, which says that when there are gaps in an ERISA plan, you give deference to the gap-filling exercise and you don't jump in as the court and fill that deference in. And I think for what it's worth, this is a plan with a very broad grant of discretion to the plan administrators.
But
it's
the plan, Judge Kraft,
sorry, go ahead.
She threw in the very practical consideration that if the plan doesn't, that won't be accepted, so ultimately the judge has to do it anyway. So why not start with the judge?
Well, but I think it's a different question. I think... I guess I take issue with the premise that if the plan does it, the court won't accept it. I mean, the court should only reject the plan's formulation if it doesn't pass the Berger test of fair and unbiased. If the plan comes back and says, you know, we're going to give everybody 4% across the board and that means nobody gets any money, I think that's something that the court could clearly reject, applying deference. I think if the plan comes back with a formula like the spread method, which I think is quite defensible, then I think the court could defer. And, of course, you know, there's plenty of opportunity. I mean, as this court well knows, the deference standard in ERISA is sufficiently flexible to take into account concerns about sort of hindsight bias or conflict of interest. I don't think there's any more conflict of interest here.
Did the plan really have that discretion, though? Wasn't it the employers that had the authority to modify the plan, not the plan itself?
No, this is a question of, I would say, either plan interpretation or in the language of the delegation of discretion.
There's nothing to interpret in that plan.
Well,
it's not there.
Well, I think that's the gap filling of Gallo. But I do want to get, I mean, I think if you focus on the discretion clause in this plan, it's 11.3, and you look at that, it's not just discretion to interpret plan terms. It's the discretion to interpret plan terms and all matters arising thereunder. So it is a broad grant of discretion to the plan administrators to interpret the plan and issues that arise under the plan. And one thing that can arise under a plan is a situation where there was a mistake. As Conkright says, people make mistakes, so do plan administrators, and you don't lose the ability to make a judgment then that's entitled to deference. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Clement.
Your Honors, please do not be tricked into stripping subclass B members of their rights. I'm going to try. It's difficult, but I'm going to try. You said ERISA requires the whipsaw calculation, and this didn't do it. It does not require the whipsaw calculation.
Monsanto, this court's decision last year, please look at it. There are two credits there. Neither one of them required a whipsaw calculation. Front-loaded versus back-loaded. It is not required. That's why I started with and why I keep pounding on contract. He absolutely correctly described Young v. Verizon, but he misrepresented the situation here. There's two things. There's the right to non-forfeitable future interest credits, and there's the price that they slapped on it. It's the price that's illegal. They had to first give us the right to non-forfeitable future interest credits. Otherwise, we had a savings account. We had more than a savings account. That's the trick. It seems so easy. Let's just get rid of this case because people got what we told them. We told them they had no right to future interest credits, but they did. There's a direct conflict. I beg the court to please look at all of the statements they made. They themselves, who wrote these communications, they said when the district court, when we filed the complaint, they moved to dismiss. They asked for exhaustion because they said, we've never thought about this before. We will not necessarily deny that. They didn't tell the district court. These are Rule 11 filings. They didn't say, we've repudiated that right. But now we'll reconsider. They said we've never considered it, never thought about it. These, you're being tricked. There's no requirement in under ERISA. 96-8, which is the law of this circuit, says there's front-loaded plans, Judge Cudahy, and there are back-loaded plans. A back-loaded plan is perfectly lawful. In addition, they didn't even put the normal retirement age in the plan. I see my time is up. Could I just finish that sentence? Thank you. Because they didn't even put in the normal retirement age under Frye v. Exelon, you also could have paid people zero, even if you found that they were front-loaded credits. Thank you, Your Honor.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.